Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
And now for something completely different.
Hey, I'm a Hall of Famer. I'm in 3 Halls of Fame. For the young fans, they don't give a damn. They just give a damn about themselves and what they're hearing now. And I got no problem with those rules. I know the rules going in. I'm happy to play the game that way.
And when Ivan came off with that knee drop from the top rope and he pinned me, I thought that something happened. I couldn't hear a thing. You could have heard a pin drop in that arena. It touched me so deeply that when I went in the dressing room, I really felt depressed.
I'll tell you that, I'll tell you right to his face. And with Hogan and I, if he wanted to get in a real street fight with me, trust me, he would lose. And he knew it.
You know, that's the other thing. They give you the belt, and they're like, okay, you're in charge of me. I was like, what?
When you mentioned a guy like Harley Race, that kind of legendary status, it's obvious why people would get upset.
As far as I'm concerned, Roddy Piper was not a wrestler. He wasn't even a good worker. If he had to go out and work his way to the top and not have good friends like Jim Barnett. I mean, I'm not saying he's not a good guy. He's just not a tough guy.
Bro, I swear to you, I don't have an ego. Like, I don't give a crap. That stuff is not important to me. People don't know me. They have no idea of who I am. They know of me as being a fictional character that they saw on TV.
People didn't understand that, you know, the guy they saw in the ring that happened to be using his real name and happened to actually be the president of the company, they really believed that that guy that they loved to hate was actually a pretty decent guy. And I think many people have the perception that I really was that character.
Hello and welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. My host, JP Jampaz. With me today, very special guest, author, writer. Of course, he's writing The Six-Pack on the Open Road in the Search of WrestleMania. The book coming out very, very soon is Mr. Brad Balakjian. Welcome to the two-man power trip. How you doing? Hope I got that right.
Hey, John. How are you? It's I just got to Rhode Island here where I grew up a couple days ago and had a big box of the books waiting for me. So it's pretty cool. It's actually real to hold the thing after all these years.
Nice. I love that. Tell us about the book and I guess the journey of writing this book.
Yeah. I mean, man, in some ways people ask you how long it takes to write a book, and in the most narrow definition of that, you might say 3 years, the point from where I wrote the proposal and then did the road trip to do the research and everything. In another way, it's been 19 years because the book starts in 2005. The first line of the book is "The Iron Sheik just threatened to kill me," and it is set back in a suburb of Atlanta where I was hanging out with the Iron Sheik back in 2005. I was working on a book with him. I grew up here in Rhode Island, loving wrestling. He was my favorite, one of my childhood heroes. I got to know him. I read about this in the prologue of the book, how I got to know the Iron Sheik. His real name is Khosrow Vaziri, so I call him Khos. And then how everything went sideways when I went to work with him in 2005 on the book. And then the whole book project fell apart. Fast forward to 2022, and I go back on the road. I drive 12,525 miles all over the country, even fly to Puerto Rico to track down the Iron Sheik once again, and several of the other wrestlers that were on the show at, in Madison Square Garden in 1983 when he won the championship from Bob Backlund. So the book is the story of the road trip, certainly the story of the WWF's expansion in the mid-80s, but I'd say even more generally, it's the story of myth versus identity and kind of what, how, to what extent these different wrestlers like Hulk Hogan and Sergeant Slaughter and Tito Santana and the Iron Sheik became or did not become the characters that they were portraying.
I love this because it's so much different than all the other wrestling books out there. It's definitely a much different journey, kind of almost blurring the lines a little bit of what they really are, who they are on TV. So is that a part of it too? You wanted to be different because so many wrestling books are exactly the same. You know what I mean? This is completely different than something you've read before as far as wrestling.
Absolutely. No, I mean that I set out to write, I like to say that if non-wrestling fans or casual wrestling fans are going to read one book in their life about professional wrestling, I hope that it's my book. That was what I was aiming for, was to have it be broad enough where a non-fan could get into it, because it is really about the humanity of these wrestlers and who they are as people and their families and all of that. Kind of the same way that if a general audience liked The Iron Claw or the movie The Wrestler, right? You know, you could appreciate that without being someone that's a diehard, you know, wrestling podcast fan or subscriber to The Observer for 30 years. But I also wanted to make sure there was plenty in there for the hardcore fan. So I was really happy I was able to talk to a bunch of people from the front office in the WWF in the mid 80s. Like the first CFO, Bob McMullen, who helped get the books together when Titan Sports was expanding in 1983. And Vince's finances were kind of a mess. He hadn't even consolidated his dad's old company, Capital Sports, with Titan Sports. They didn't have a line of credit. They had agents running around with hundreds of thousands of dollars in briefcases after house shows to make it, you know, waiting weeks to make a deposit at the office or at the bank. So talking to guys like that, talking to Jim Troy, who was Vince's sort of sidekick in those early years, talking to Ed Ricciuti, who edited the WWF magazine, Ed Helinski, who started the first WWF magazine called Victory in 1983. I really got into and was able to get a lot of details on, you know, things like how much Hulk Hogan got paid for WrestleMania I and how the name WrestleMania actually came about, because there's a lot of misinformation out there about those things. So I think the hardcore fans will also find plenty in there that they like.
When you're looking at the book, right, and I'm thinking like, wow, Iron Sheik, the first thing I'm thinking like, what the hell is Iron Sheik's problem? What's wrong with him? What's going on? I mean, you're going to help him write this book and he completely turns heel on you. What's up with the Iron Sheik?
Well, to be fair to the Iron Sheik, I think hopefully I did justice to the overall context of that story in the book. But at that point, 2005, you know, his daughter had been brutally and abruptly murdered 2 years prior. And that just destroyed him, right? And that just really set him off. He was already kind of in a dark place. It went a lot worse. And then just the drug addiction. You know, there's no secret that the Iron Sheik had all kinds of drug issues. And I think in the years following my failed project with him, that's when he was all over Twitter and Howard Stern. And, you know, I thought it was always kind of sad that it seemed like a lot of people were kind of capitalizing on his pain and his addiction, because that was essentially a work, right? That version of the Iron Sheik. And so what I wanted to do in this book is really tell the story of Khosrow Vaziri. So I go all the way back and tell the history of the relationship between Iran and the United States, and, you know, giving some context to back in 1983, American wrestling fans, they just hated the Iron Sheik because he was from Iran, right? It was this just very simplistic formula of the U.S. is all good and the, you know, any foreign country is bad. And when you go into the history of the country of Persia and the United States, and you realize the bigger picture of why Iranians and Americans have this history, it gives you a little more complexity and nuance to that whole story. And And I think paints the Iron Sheik, Khosrow Baziri, in a more humanizing, sympathetic light. I went back, I found the guy that when the Iron Sheik got on a plane from Iran in 1969 to come to the United States, well before the Iron Sheik was anywhere close to being in his mind, he was a 190-pound amateur wrestling star named Khosrow Baziri. And he gets on a plane, not speaking a word of English. And all he's got in his pocket is the name Alan Rice, who was an amateur wrestling coach in Minnesota, the Minnesota Wrestling Club, who he had met at some international competition. He gets off the plane in Minneapolis in late fall, and he's wandering around the airport, just going up to anyone saying, Alan Rice, Alan Rice. Someone finally recognizes the name and calls Alan Rice and say, hey, there's a guy here who doesn't speak any English, who's just saying your name over and over. And Alan Rice got him to his house and put him up for a while until Kaz could get on his feet. And so I actually tracked down Alan Rice, who was like 94 years old, living in a retirement home in Naples, Florida. You know, I went and found the amateur wrestlers that Kaz trained in Minneapolis in 1972 and 1976, guys like Dan Chandler and Pat Marcy, to meet and talk to these guys who knew the Iron Sheik way, way before he was the cartoonish wrestling character, let alone the guy that he was on Howard Stern.
Pretty crazy, like when you're really digging into the weeds there and you're able to find these guys. Are you amazed that sometimes you could find like Alan Rice and some of these people? Because it feels like, wow, that's got to be a needle in a haystack sometimes.
I mean, that's why like doing books like this is just a shit ton of work, man. Like, I mean, it's years of research, and you become almost like a detective, going through public records databases, old newspaper archives, you know, going down a dozen dead ends for every one that turns up. I mean, my first book was called The Wax Pack, about tracking out all these former professional baseball players in a pack of baseball cards. And I had to do the same thing for that, where you really have to, you know, people, it's easy to have ideas about writing a book or I want to do that, but to actually like execute and go on the road and find all these people is just, it takes a borderline obsession to be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you really got to, like, Alan Rice, you got to find that story, then you got to find him, and that's kind of, not a common name, but kind of a common name. It could be, so it might not be the right guy. So,
right, and then you got to convince people to talk to you, you know, who knows if they're going to talk to you, you know, and I mean, part of my books is that I don't want to just write a book from sitting at home on my couch. I get out and I go on the road and I meet these people where they are, and I talk about, you know, whether that was going to Hulk Hogan's karaoke bar or going to Bill Eadie's hometown in Brownsville, Pennsylvania, and finding people he grew up and went to school with, going to Tito Santana's hometown in Mission, Texas, and talking to his cousin who took me around to show me the house he grew up in, right? That, to me, it's storytelling. It's you want to paint as full a picture as you can of these guys, so that, again, they're not just some character on TV. They're three-dimensional, fully realized people.
When you look at that too, it's like some might not want to talk to you, but they'd be so integral for the story, or they would make the story better, but sometimes they don't want to talk to you, right? I mean, that obviously can happen.
Yeah, and that did happen. I mean, one of the chapter on Sergeant Slaughter is all about him putting me off and going to, you know, like I had tracked down one of his best friends from high school, and his friend was like texting me like, oh yeah, sure, I'd be happy to talk to you. We set up a time, and 3 days later he wrote back and said, oh, I'm sorry, but Bob, Sergeant Slaughter's real name is Bob Remus, you know, Bob told me he doesn't want me to talk to you. So it's like, wow. So what do you do as a writer when the person you're, the subject of your work, doesn't want to talk to you and is actively obstructing your research, right? So with Bob, with Slaughter, I went to Burlington, North Carolina to knock, literally knock on his door at his house. You know, so I'm willing to go to some pretty extreme lengths to try to find these guys.
Did he eventually kind of warm up to you, or is he still kind of standoffish?
Well, I'm going to leave that one to the, so there's a twist in there. I'm not going to give it
away. Oh, okay. All right. I just started, so I got to keep going. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And, you'll see. I mean, it's unexpected how it all turns out. I'll put it that way.
That is so interesting because it's like, okay, the guy tells somebody else not to talk to you. So you won't get any story if you don't actually talk to Slaughter. You know what I mean? It's just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, John, you interview a lot of wrestling personalities and guys. I mean, I'm sure there's some guys that are harder to talk to than others,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Happens all the time. And you literally sometimes have it set up. And then it gets canceled. Like you said, it will get canceled. And you literally are talking to the guy and he's like, oh, let me see if the agent or whoever's okay with it. I'm like, but I'm talking to you. I want to know if you're okay with it. And then they
And I don't know. I mean, have you encountered where the guys, they want you to pay them, that kind of thing?
Sometimes they do. And I say, this isn't paid. So then sometimes that could be a hurdle too. So sometimes. Yeah,
you'll see when you get to it in the book, like with two of the guys, Tito Santana and Tony Atlas, they refused to talk to me if I didn't pay them. So, and just like you, I said, well, that's not how this works. Like, this is not, you know, this is journalism. This isn't public relations. And they didn't care. And I understand, like, you know, part of their cynicism or suspicion or protectiveness around their time is that they were, a lot of these guys were exploited for many years by unscrupulous promoters. And so I get why they're very defensive. So for those two guys, I said, okay, well, I'll pay you, but I'm going to disclose that to the reader. Because my thing is, like, I want to be upfront and honest and transparent. So if I'm paying you, the reader needs to know that. And so I put that in the book.
Yep. Yeah. Some guys are like, well, no. And then they'll come back to you later on when they have something they want to plug. So, you know, then eventually you end up getting them. But yeah, it could be kind of a pain in the ass, or they just don't want to talk to you in general. Or sometimes if they have some sort of affiliation with WWE, they're like, oh, you got to go through WWE to do it. So there are definitely a lot of hurdles, and it can be a big pain in the ass sometimes getting them to actually talk to you.
Right, right.
And sometimes you're like, oh, my God, this is great. You know, I found the golden goose. I you know, have the contact info. And then once you have it, it goes nowhere. So it's like, there's you know what I mean? There's levels and stages to it. Like, first of all, finding them, then making sure it's them. And you know what I mean? There's levels to it. And once you get to that final level, it could stink if it's not going to, you know, it's not going to land the interview. It kind of stinks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you're going around, right, let's say Jim Troy, for instance, is that something that's like a huge hurdle? Do you have to go through stuff, or was he kind of more forthcoming than maybe I would think he would be?
Yeah, I think a lot of these guys, those the office guys, so Jim Troy, Tom Emanuel, who was the publisher of WWF Magazine, Nelson Sweglar, who was the head of TV production for many years. Those guys, once I reached them, pretty much all of them were like, yeah, sure, I'll talk to you. They, you know, they were not difficult or worried. And most of them had not really been approached very much. I think a lot of times we overlook the guys behind the scenes in any business, but in wrestling as well, that we always were drawn to the stars and the performers. But, you know, for every performer, there's several people that are doing something behind the scenes and in the office that makes it all work. And they're often some of the best sources for information. So, yeah, those guys were great. I had some crazy stories that Jim Troy shared with me about things that's almost never been reported on, which are the tours to the Middle East in the WWF in the mid 80s. They went over to Kuwait and Bahrain and Qatar in like 83, 84, 85, Jordan, Egypt. And some crazy shit went down on those plane rides. Talk about the plane ride from hell. The original plane ride from hell is in my book, based on what happened with Jimmy Snuka and one of the referees and all this stuff. So, and that stuff, like, there's almost no trace of that in anywhere. You know, I mean, that was completely new information that I was able to get by talking to them.
I feel like that's not even available, like results, you know, you want to look up results.
I mean, I was trying to fact check, and I could not. I mean, even with Jim Troy, who was there, we couldn't figure out necessarily all the order of the dates and the shows. Like, no one, I mean, History of WWE, wrestling.data.com, Old Observer, The Observer back then didn't even know those tours were happening. So really, I mean, we all know wrestling fans are hardcore and, you know their stuff and have their information, but even the hardest of hardcore fans have not been able to really pinpoint that history.
That's kind of crazy if you think about it, because we're obsessed with results, and we can have stuff from like, hey, Jim Londos wrestled in 1932, you know, during the Depression or something. Like, we could have that, but wow, that's kind of hidden.
One of the real gems that came out of my research was a former employee of WWF gave me Vince McMahon Sr.'s planner from 1963 and from 1970. That has like the day by day of who wrestled who. that he rescued from the warehouse was going to get thrown out in a dumpster in like 1987. And he just grabbed it and he gave it to me. And so I have all these, documents. Like, again, the wrestling community is going to love this stuff. Like, I got all these internal WWF documents from former employees and from lawsuit discovery files that had never been digitized that show like how many, you know, what was the payoff at this house show in 1989 and what was the attendance and how much did this pay-per-view make? So all that documentation I'm going to be putting on my, I'm launching a online magazine on April 2nd, the day my book comes out, which is going to have, I'm going to be posting all that material. So, you know, if there's hardcore fans out there, I think they'll dig that.
Where can they find that? Like what's going to be
The bradpack.com is the website. And yeah, it'll, so I have all this, like I'm calling it bonus material for the book, because just like in the old days, you know, you'd buy a DVD and it would have all the special features.
Yep.
Like I've always felt like, why don't books have that? Right. Like I have all this additional material that I didn't use, like bunch of people I interviewed, audio from those interviews, documents, photos, stuff from people's personal collections that I think fans would love to see. So I'm going to wrap all that into the bonus material.
That's really cool. People are going to be really into that. So like Vince McMahon Sr.'s planner, if you will, I know the rumor was always like if he had it in the planner, it happened. There wasn't like a deviation. Not that he couldn't, he would, but it was one of those things. Like it was like more of like a promise. He was a very honest and forthright guy. Is that kind of what you saw?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, from interviewing all these wrestlers and people in the office, like there was definitely a difference in how people, what people thought of Vince McMahon Sr. and Vince McMahon Jr. Pretty much across the board, people seem to respect Sr. And if there's one heel that comes out of my whole book and it, you know, and there's a lot of guys in my book that, you know, they made mistakes. They're not perfect. But the weight of the evidence when you're evaluating the totality of someone and their character, the only person that really kind of tips over on the not so good side is Vince McMahon Jr.
It always seems like whenever I interview the guys, and I love the guys that work for both, because I'm like, what's the difference? And it's usually basically Vince Jr., cutthroat, all business. He'll tell you something that might not come true. Vince Sr., all business, very serious, very honest. If he tells you something, it does come true. So it's like, wow, there is very difference between Sr. and Jr. And I haven't heard anybody that I've interviewed. I interviewed a ton of guys that said like they're alike. Very right. much opposite.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. One of the biggest, I got to give a lot of credit, for the help I got from Eric Bischoff with this whole project, who was very, who I got to know before I wrote the book through my first book. And Eric was so helpful in getting me in touch with people and very supportive. And it's interesting when I thought about, as I'm writing and researching the book, you know, in the 90s, we had, you know, Eric Bischoff on one side and Vince McMahon on the other side. And, you know, Eric's character on TV was very cocky and everything. And so some people probably, I always wondered like, how are these guys similar? Are they similar? Are they different? And after doing this whole book, it's like they're very different people. You know, I have a lot more respect for Eric Bischoff than for Vince. Certainly, Vince was an incredibly successful businessman, and you can't knock what he accomplished. And even his biggest detractors will say, you know, guy was brilliant in terms of how he did what no one else could do. But, you know, how... do the ends justify the means, right? And right. The question, you know, his ruthlessness in getting and doing that expansion is what I think, you know, leads you to question his character.
So it's like the WWF succeeds, he succeeds, and all those other people just die off to the wayside, and he doesn't give a damn. He's gonna barrel over them in global domination.
Well, and I have a whole chapter in there, the Bill Eady, who was, you know, mass superstar, Demolition Axe, about how he sued Vince in a lawsuit that's barely ever been discussed about being underpaid and sort of the questionable legal nature of these boilerplate contracts that Vince had made all these guys sign in the mid-80s on, where they're independent contractors. And you look at those contracts, and I've seen them, and they're just insane how little power they give to the talent, and how we could describe them even today as independent contractors. You know, an independent contractor, as defined by the IRS, is supposed to be able to go work for other people if they want. But especially in the 80s, when you were on the road 330 days a year and working more than full time for the WWF, how could you possibly, first of all, you had no time to work for anyone else, and then they wouldn't let you work for anyone else.
It's crazy. And I was good friends with King Kong Bundy before he passed. And I actually was kind of like a pseudo manager, which a lot of people will never know or don't know. But I actually would travel around with him sometimes and pick him up because he didn't live too far from me. He lived in Glassboro by the Asbury Park area. So not too far. So I would drive him around. But he showed me that old picture of him with that computer. And I said, that's amazing. And Vince let you do that. He said he did not. That's why he hates me. That's why I wasn't in the Hall of Fame. Like, he brought him back in the mid-90s, yes. But he goes, remember, I jobbed to Brad, jobbed to Diesel, yeah. Jobbed to Shawn Michaels. He's like, so he liked me to a certain extent where he could make money off me, but he didn't like me because I did that. And I said, hey, I'm an independent contractor, Vinny. I could, you know, busting his balls. He's like, he was very sarcastic, and he was a wise ass too. But he was saying Vince always held that against him. And even when he brought him back, he goes, haha, selling any computers lately? Like, he would have it in his head. So even if you did stuff as an independent contractor to go against Vince, he would kind of find a way to either get you back or, you know, needle you on and keep bringing it up to you.
Are you, are you in Asbury Park?
Yes.
Well, that's great. So that you're probably aware that that's where the Iron Sheik famously got arrested with Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
Yes.
In May of 1987. So I, you know, for cocaine and open container and marijuana, I was actually able to track down literally the cop who arrested the Iron Sheik and the Hacksaw Jim Duggan in the book. And unfortunately, he refused to talk to me. I don't know why, but it was pretty cool to like actually find the actual police officer that arrested him. That whole story is in the book, and another story that never gets talked about, 2 years prior, where the Iron Sheik got arrested for allegedly assaulting a gas station attendant and how that all played out. So there's a lot of new ground I was able to break in there.
Yeah, you're getting some awesome stories that definitely haven't heard before, which is crazy in the wrestling world when everybody loves to find information and talk about it and, you know, kind of create their own narrative around some of those stories. So it's amazing you're finding the stuff that, you know, we've never seen or heard of before.
Yeah, and to your earlier point about the book being different, I mean, there's been a lot of, you know, great wrestling books that have been written, whether they're the autobiographies like Bret Hart and Mick Foley, but also the historical stuff, like I really like Tim Hornbaker's book about the death of the territories. Yep. And I think like your point about this being different, it's a wrestling book that's never been done before, which is that it's not really focused just on wrestling because it's about these bigger themes of these guys as people. So in that sense, it kind of fits in a different slot than in the wrestling bibliography. And I hope that, you know, I hope that people I hope people dig that they see that it's that it is not the same thing. It's something that's ambitious and different. And hopefully it works.
And I love that you kind of bring up stuff like Axe or Bill Eady, Axe and Demolition, and people always assume it's the concussion lawsuit. That was the second lawsuit that he filed against Vince that kind of is the reason why Demolition isn't in the WWE Hall of Fame and the reason why they aren't kind of mentioned and kind of glorified and how they were kind of ignored for a while. But it's great that you mentioned that because everyone assumes, it was the concussion lawsuit. Actually, it was the first lawsuit, and then the second one really probably pissed Vince off.
Yeah, by the time the second one came around, like, you know, the damage had been done in Vince's eyes. But to your point, the second one was relevant. I went and knocked on the door of the lawyer, Konstantin Kuros, who defended all those guys in Hingham, Massachusetts. So I went, got in my car, and I remember it was like right after Halloween 2022. And I stood in the guy's doorway for an hour and a half chatting with him about that lawsuit and, you know, what happened there. Why did it not work when the NHL and the NFL lawsuits were more successful?
I feel like with Bill Eady in particular, also Vince probably didn't like him, almost like Bundy, where they found like a way not to screw him, but to help themselves because he owned the Demolition name technically.
Yeah. Axe. Well, that was part of the issue in the lawsuit was
right.
I really kind of got into that in detail, that really part of what Bill Eady was saying in the lawsuit was, hey, you didn't even come up with Demolition. Like, it was really Randy Colley, Moondog Rex's idea with Bill Eadie. You know, the history there is that Bill Eadie had been one of the machines in late 1986. Randy Colley was Moondog Rex. The machines was just a short-lived gimmick, you know, to have Andre the Giant come in under the hood.
Yep.
And then while they were together, like, I think Randy Colley was looking for a change, and Bill knew that this machine thing was short-lived. So they just went into creative overdrive and just started brainstorming all these ideas. And, you know, Bill talks about the evolution of Demolition. Like, at one point they were going to have monkey masks and all these crazy ideas, and it, you know, really evolved. And then they debut it in January of 87 with, and I'm sure you probably have heard that this story's made the rounds, with Randy Colley as Smash. Yep. And the fans recognize him, right? And just shit on it. And so it's obvious it's not going to work. So I guess Vince tells Randy Colley, don't worry, we're going to create something new for you. And meanwhile, they get Barry Darso to play Smash. Demolition takes off. Poor Randy Colley, the great idea that Vince promised was to make him one of the Shadows with Jose Luis Rivera, who's another guy I wrote about in the book. He's another, got his own chapter. And, you know, Demolition does great. And then in the lawsuit, you know, Vince is claiming that he is responsible for the name, the likeness, the character development of Demolition, even though not only did Bill and Randy come up with it, but, you know, they lived, Bill and Barry lived the characters for like 4 years, 5 years, right? I mean, they are embodying literally these characters. And so, you know, it's pretty far-fetched for Vince to claim that is his creation. But it's all about control, like you said, with Vince.
Yep.
Vince wants to have control. Vince doesn't want other people to have, you know, the control.
I've noticed that any guy that has, like, the inkling of having the control, or, like, Jesse the Body, of course, had a problem with him. Ultimate Warrior had a problem with him. Hulk Hogan had a huge problem with him because he's like, no, I created WWF. And Hogan's like, well, without me, you're nothing, brother. You know what I mean? And, you know, I want my name. So that is such a thing about Vince. It's like, if he's not controlling it, there is a problem, an issue with you and him.
Yeah, no, and that comes through loud and clear in the book over and over again, with whether you're, you know, big name talent or lesser, you know, it's pretty much the same. And also, you know, one thing I want to say is that I didn't really get to get into this, and I didn't get to interview her. That would have been great. But the person it's always underappreciated and underrated in the WWF's expansion in the mid 80s and success is Linda McMahon. Linda McMahon, truly, I mean, in 1981, 82, you know, Vince's dad still owns the company. Vince is living with Linda in out by Cape Cod, running the Cape Cod Coliseum on a lease. They need a regular act to make the bills. So they get a hockey team in, which is how he meets Jim Troy. You know, and in those early years, it's Vince and Linda in a little, you know, concrete walled office with yellow legal pads, just doing everything. You know, I think at that point they may have had Howard Finkel on. They had Ed Cohen, the Booker, come in pretty soon. But, you know, and I think Linda, you know, Vince has said he barely got through college. You know, Linda was, I think, very smart, very sharp, and was kind of the detail person, the person that really did the nuts and bolts in those early years. You know, I got some of these internal memos from the WWF office in 83, 84, when they were at 81 Holly Hill Lane in Greenwich, Connecticut. And, you know, you can see that Linda is managing the details, the minutiae of the day to day, and completely under the radar as far as history goes.
Any chance that you could talk to her? It was one of those things where she doesn't do wrestling interviews, because it seems like she's so far away from wrestling that couldn't get any further.
I don't think she does any interview. I mean, I tried, you know, I got an email. I don't know if it was the right email address. She never wrote back. You know, she's very involved with political stuff now, but is very almost never in the press. I know she's very reclusive, so doubtful that she would talk to me.
Yeah, and the rumor is, or I guess Bruce Pritchard said it several years ago, him and Linda and Vince have been separated for like a decade or something like that. And people, right. Nobody said anything because she kept the name, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So she's staying far away and obviously completely far away now, even further far away if she can.
Right. Exactly.
Now, you mentioned before about Iron Sheik and his craziness with, you know, the Howard Stern stuff. I was just curious with that because, and I've talked to Brian Blair about it. There's like one instance with Brian Blair, and then all of a sudden he hates Brian Blair for the rest of his life. It could be partially a work, of course, too. It could be a joke. But it almost seems like he was like a trigger. Like he mentioned him like, oh, Brian Blair, that cheap SOB, blah, 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 and then he goes crazy. Right? I mean, did you ever like find out like some of his triggers and why that they're triggers? Because Blair says basically that they had been wrestling and Sheik was wiping the mat with everybody. And Blair like gave him a good match. They like, gave him a good fight. So, of course, the boys ribbed him like, oh, Blair got you. Not necessarily really got him, but he didn't kill him like everybody else. So that got stuck in his head. Is there stuff with him that were like triggers for Sheik?
Yeah, I think so. One thing, Khosrow, Aziri, Iron Sheik just had a lot of pride, right? Just a very prideful man and really took himself very seriously as a great amateur wrestler. And, you know, he had an ego. And so I think the fact that, you know, Blair bested him on that one occasion always, you know, annoyed him or sat wrong with him. In terms of why that became such a thing, I think that really was an example of his drug addiction, you know, affecting his personality. I mean, chemically, the guy was imbalanced because of all these drugs in his system. And so these things would set him off. I mean, I was when he threatened to kill me in his living room is because I said something so innocuous, but he would just go off at nothing. And that's, I think, part of the effect on the personality that happens with the drug addiction. So I think they had those triggers. I think also with the Brian, I mean, remember the Brian Blair thing, it's like he made the comment in a shoot interview that went viral.
Yep.
So this is now in the 2000s and he's still touring and traveling, and everywhere he goes, every interview he does, everyone's just, hey, talk about Brian Blair, talk about Brian Blair, talk about Hulk Hogan. So they're just feeding his ego in terms of, you know, wanting him to perform. And so like these wrestlers, that they're kind of, they're addicted to the attention and they want the spotlight. And so I think that just became more and more exaggerated. And he was basically working at that point. I don't think he really hated Brian Blair. You know, that I think was all exaggerated by everything.
The Hogan stuff too, obviously exaggerated, but people love it online, you know, F the whole Hogan stuff, but Sheik, right? He wasn't even controlling social media. I was told he doesn't even know how to use Instagram and stuff like
right
that.
And that's what I talk about that in the book. It bothered me that this not even Iron Sheik talking, right? It's like, this is so, I mean, okay, great. That's why wrestling, pro wrestling is an industry predicated on illusion and the perpetuation of illusion, right? And that's the fun of it. That's why it's an escape for us. It's an alternate reality where we're allowed to just inhabit that world. But for a book about the people in the industry, my goal was to basically fact check I want to find the truth in wrestling. I want to know where that line is between myth and reality. It matters to me what is true and what is not, what's a work and what's a shoot. And that's hard to do because the industry for so long was all about misdirection and misconceptions and everything. And so something like the Iron Sheik, okay, you know, we see his degree of popularity because of this character he's playing, but you know, who was actually saying those things? What does the Iron Sheik really believe? Those things were important to me to make clear in the book.
Watching an old X-Files episode, Mulder is talking to an FBI guy. The FBI guy says to him, he's a higher thing. He said, 99% of people don't know what's going on. Like only 1% of people are clued in. So when I'm thinking about Sheik, right? And I'm like the Instagram and the Twitter and stuff. I'm like, I bet you 99% of people think that's Iron Sheik saying I'm making you humble. Yeah. The whole code. And I'm like, man, so many people don't realize that's not Sheik. That's somebody capitalizing off of Sheik's name and likeness and his gimmick.
Right. Right. And I don't have a problem with these characters being fun and all that. I have a, I just have a problem when it's not, it, when it's not open that it's not true. Right. Like I just want transparency around these things, you know, which is why, I mean, I think I like the state of wrestling now because there's no more questions around like, oh, is it, you know, is it real or not? We all know what it is, but we can still celebrate it and still enjoy it knowing that it's a show. Right. And I think that part of why life was so difficult for the guys that wrote about in this book, because they were wrestling in an era when they were expected to live this lie as well, that they were expected to stay in character or to be their character.
Couldn't break kayfabe back then. So Iron Sheik's got to be Iron Sheik, not Kazuro Vashiri kind of thing.
Yeah. And then that has a lot of collateral damage effects, like people putting sugar in his gas tank and calling in death threats and slashing his tires and, you know, him telling his daughters, don't tell your friends at school who I am because they might try to hurt you. I mean, that's not funny anymore, right? That's not a game. That's real life, you know, the show bleeding into real lives and affecting families in ways that is just not, you know, not appropriate.
When you go back and you look at the book, what was like the most fun? Now, obviously, the completion of it, we know that. But like, what was the most fun? Was it actually going on the hunt for the interviews, or was it kind of securing random guys? Or like, what was the favorite part of the book?
After things went sideways with the Iron Sheik, having the opportunity to see him again, and you know, really, actually, shortly before he died, which of course I had no way of knowing that was going to happen. That's got to be the highlight. I mean, this, you know, this is a book about wrestling, but it's the Iron Sheik is definitely kind of the star of the book. Beyond that, I would say that it was, I think, tracking down some of those guys from the front office in the WWF that had never really spoken before and getting some of that information that I just knew was like, you know, breaking new ground. And again, as you said, there's so much that's repeated in wrestling history and lore, so to find something new was really exciting.
What was the worst part of the book?
Well, certainly the part in the beginning, which is in the past, when the Iron Sheik was threatening to kill me. I mean, that's just surreal when your childhood hero is, you know, is hating you. That was certainly awful. Beyond that, I would say that there was one night on the road where I couldn't get a hotel and I had to sleep in my car, and that was pretty miserable. And so, you know, this wasn't a fancy trip. I mean, I'm staying in a lot of roach motels and, you know, a lot of long days on the road, but in a way that was good because I was getting a little bit of a taste of what these guys went through in living on the road. And one other thing that was fun, but also hard, was there's a chapter in the book about this where I went in the ring myself and did a day of training. So like learning what it feels like to take a bump, that was painful.
Yes, definitely. Done that sometime, did some training, and your lungs, surprisingly, it's like, wow, damn, like you really feel it when you start really taking those bumps, especially back to back.
Exactly, yeah.
So as far as you and like a financial burden, you're on the road, you're doing this. Was it a financial burden? Because technically, you know, you're out there and you're going from town to town. You're not necessarily like working countdown, but you're driving around. I mean, you're trying to get research and stuff. So was it a financial burden going around and doing the 12,000 miles?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm a scientist, a part-time professor and scientist and journalist. And I think the most money I've ever made in a year, I'm 43 years old, I've never made more than $70,000 in a year. So for people that are out there thinking that like writers are making killings off their books, like it's a tough business. I had to fund, I mean, I had a book deal. I have a book deal, but I still had to fund all of my own travel. So I'm, you know, paying for my own hotels and gas and time and everything. This is why, I always encourage people, if they're interested in my books, and, you know, please buy it new versus used, you know, like being able to, the only way that these projects can happen and can continue to happen is if people actually go out and buy the book and support it.
Now, I got to go all the way back, because I know you talk about it in the book, Providence Civic Center, you going to shows back then. I love that because, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I would go to the Meadowlands or Brendan Byrne Arena, I guess, back then, or MSG, which is still around, but I mean the old school shows, go to Philly for some shows. What was it like there? Because I feel like that's a cool venue and maybe doesn't get talked about enough because WWF go there a lot for shows.
Dude, I wish I had, like, I know in the old, you know, it's funny, like, I'm sure you've been to shows recently. I just went to one recently and now you can't even bring a backpack in, right? You have like clear bag only. And I love, like, when you see those things pop up online, like the fan cams, the handheld from like a random house show in Providence in 91 or 86. And I'm like, how the hell did they smuggle like a camcorder into the arena? Because back then the cameras were this big, you know?
But
WWF ran Providence almost every month in like the 80s, 70s and 80s. And I mean, my recollections are foggy because I was just a kid, but I just remember simple presentation, right? Spotlight on the ring. Maybe they started getting music, entrance music, but just a good hot crowd. You know, they would draw pretty well. So you'd probably have, you know, 6, 8, 10,000 for those shows. That was the squeaky little voice in the nosebleed seats cheering for the Iron Sheik when no one else was. Providence is a great WWF market for many, many years. And I think you said underrated because the Spectrum and the Boston Garden and Madison Square Garden, you know, they get a lot of the credit, Meadowlands.
But I feel like Providence, and even listening to like Jake the Snake or Hogan in old interviews talk about it, sometimes they would do stuff in a loop, and Providence was a part of the loop because they're testing something out. Like Jake versus Hogan, for instance, was tried out in Providence.
And they did the King of the Ring that started in Providence. The famous, I saw footage online, just a little clip from a news station of Jake and Hogan in Providence in like 1987 or something.
Do you remember what shows you went to? Like, can you remember main events and stuff?
My earliest memory was probably a show in probably like 85 or 86. I remember it had like the Funk Brothers and the Moondogs and Sheik and Volkoff. But I don't remember beyond that, like the specific, you know, main events. Yeah.
Did you love it though as a kid? Because I know your dad was not a fan.
No, I was all about it. I mean, wrestling was, you know, wrestling, baseball cards, Star Wars, like those were my, you know, my passions. And I had all the figures and my Saturday night's main event. And I think so many of us that grew up in the 80s, we have such fond memories and nostalgia for that time period.
I feel like a bit spoiled too, because I'm about your age. I'll be 42 coming up. So by your age, I feel like we were spoiled in that with all those awesome characters and the LJNs coming out and, you know, the TV shows being as good as they were. I feel like we were, as a wrestling fan, we were just super spoiled back then.
Yeah. And I don't, at the risk of being the old guys that are like, well, it was better when we were kids. Like I was watching Raw the other night and I was like, I think there's a lot of good stuff happening in wrestling now, but I was trying to pinpoint, like, what is it that, I mean, obviously we're a little biased because we have our childhood, you know, memories. But looking at the presentation now, I feel like because it's now like most characters are just like they're just their names, right? They're not gimmicks anymore. Like I feel like there's just a lot of repetition and sort of monotony in some of the presentation of the characters that none of them stand out as sort of very distinct. And then I think that also the in-ring part, like they're undoubtedly more athletic and more impressive in their working now than they were in our childhood era. But the story, the psychology of a lot of matches, I mean, some matches are brilliant, but some of them, you know, it's kind of like, oh, it's a lot of high spots for 5 minutes and not a lot of story. So I get like when some of the old timers, like a Bret Hart or a Jake the Snake, will say like, you know, we got a lot more out of a lot less.
For sure. And they were wrestling a lot more too back then. And they got a lot more out of a lot less. I feel like the guys were, easily more defined, like Iron Sheik. You know what Iron Sheik is, and you're like Hogan. You know what he is, Jake the Snake. You know what he is. They were better defined back then, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, to be clear, I don't think that they could go back to that formula because the world is different now. I mean, yeah. you can't just have these simplistic cartoonish characters. But I think there's a balance to be struck. I think that they could get back to a little bit of that, you know, without going fully to what it was.
Like, that's why I think a guy like Bray Wyatt stood out so much. He was so different. He could have fit in with those guys in the 80s with that gimmick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So when you look at, like, back then, you mentioned in the book, obviously, your dad, not a fan, but he would take you to the shows. So he wasn't a fan growing up. And that's not why, like, you didn't kind of become a fan because your dad became a fan.
Yeah, well, so, became a
fan on your own.
You know, the father and son thing, my first book, The Wax Pack, was all, so much of that was about how I loved baseball because my dad loved baseball. This was the opposite, right? This was like my dad cringing that I liked wrestling. But also part of why I dedicated the book to him was because even though he didn't like it, he still took me to the shows. And that right. was what a great yep. father he was. So, you know, I think in some ways you mimic and you follow your parents. In other ways, you might totally take a different path and rebel or whatever. And so this was one of these things that, you know, there was no one else around me in my family that liked wrestling. I think for me, I liked it because I was a pretty shy, insecure kid, and it just allowed me to escape into this world of strength and confidence that I admired.
What do you think drew you to wrestling, though? Like, what obviously it wasn't your dad saying, "Hey, I'm watching this." You know, watch. What do you think drew it to you? Was it the larger than life characters, or was it something else?
Yeah, I think it was these guys were superheroes, right? For us as kids, they were you know these good guys and bad guys that we could. You know, the formula was simple. It's basic storytelling. I think anyone. Any presentation of storytelling with that formula of good versus evil can really resonate with young kids, especially when you add in the production values of the TV and the characters and the costumes and the color and all of that. It just had this, you know, and I think that's where Vince changed the industry to really up the production value of the presentation visually, you know, that really sucked in a lot of young kids at that time.
Looking back too, I mean, obviously nostalgia is we love it, but it's just like those characters were larger than life. They were bigger than anything. It just came off as superheroes, but they were real. You know what I mean? Like they were realistic superheroes. So I feel like that's what kind of drew so many fans. And that's why 33 million people watching Hogan, Andre wrestle and stuff. I feel like that's what drew is like, wow, these guys are real life superheroes, but they're actually real.
Right. Right. They're You know, it's not like, and that's sort of the point of the book is that Hulk Hogan leaves the arena. And unlike, you know, the person playing Batman who turns in his costume and walks away, Hulk Hogan, if he goes to get a soda, is going to be perceived as Hulk Hogan in the 7-Eleven, right?
Yeah.
If there's no like, oh, hello, Terry Bollea. Like, tell me about growing up in Tampa. It's like, no, you are 303 pounds from Venice Beach, California, brother, right? It's like, yeah. And so that there's no equivalent to that in entertainment back then. You know, it's like rock stars. I mean, I guess rock stars were still they're who they were, but I think there was nothing was like the schedule that and the physicality that these wrestlers went through back then.
Now, you know that you were supposed to like Hogan and not Iron Sheik, right? I mean, what were you doing as a kid liking Sheiky Baby?
But I do clarify in the I did like Hogan. Hogan was my number two, I know sounds like how can you like them both, but I did. You know, if head to head, I would give Iron Sheik the nod, but yeah, I was a Hulkamaniac. I certainly, you know, in the chapter about Hulk, I talk about that and why I liked Hulk and why I think so many people did and why his character worked, you know, based on his experience in music. And so I was able to track down the people he was in a band with that he grew up with, really talk about Terry Bollea before he was Hulk Hogan and get a sense for what went into the creation of Hulk Hogan and music, the band Ruckus, that was a big part of it.
So as we hit the wind down here, we head towards the finish. Give us like a one big push, but not yet for the six pack. Give us one big push for the wax pack, like the baseball book, because I know a lot of obviously wrestling fans are probably baseball fans as well.
Yeah, thanks. The wax pack was where this whole pack open road series started. Came out in 2020. Just the same like we're talking about when I was growing up, actually in the house I grew up in, which is really nice here in Rhode Island. And at 5-6 years old, I was playing with my wrestling figures and collecting baseball cards. So I had this idea several years ago of what if I got a pack of 1986 Topps baseball cards, which is the first year that I collected them. And whoever opened it up and whoever's in that pack go on a road trip to find all those guys and tell the story of what happened to these players after they were done. And so I did that. I took a trip and found, you know, it ranged from super famous guys like Carlton Fisk to the quote unquote jobbers of baseball, which would be someone like Jaime Coconauer, who's no one's heard of. And the book did great. It was a NPR best book of the year in 2020. I was really happy with how it turned out. And that success enabled me to take on this book.
Who is your favorite baseball player of all time?
Well, unsurprisingly, if you know my story at all, it was Don Carmen, which no one knows. Excuse me. But the same way I like the Iron Sheik because he was like the person you weren't supposed to like, I always liked the bench warmers in baseball, the guys that were not the stars. And so Don Carmen was part of my book and one of the – he's kind of the Iron Sheik of the wax pack, I'd say, the star of that book.
Love that. So not Barry Bonds or some great player, Ricky Anderson.
No. I mean, that's what most people do, but I'm definitely not like most people. So
now, as far as the six pack, give us a big push for the book, why everybody should get it. And, you know, also why it's so much different than the other wrestling books that are out there.
Yeah. I think if you are a fan of, you know, the old days, the 80s in wrestling, you'll really appreciate the celebration of that era. It'll bring back a lot of warm feelings from your childhood and it will give you an appreciation for who these guys are as people. And I think you'll really respect them and appreciate them even more after reading about their life stories. Well beyond wrestling. So the book comes out April 2nd. You can go to thebradpack.com to find information about how to order. You can get it at any bookstore, Amazon, wherever wherever books are sold, as they say. And I hope people enjoy it. I hope they let me know. Get in touch with me on social media, Twitter, Instagram, at @BradPackBooks. I'm happy to chat with you about what you think. And I just appreciate you having me on, John. And, you know, it's been nice to chop it up with a fellow fan from that era.
Yes, I always refer to it as the Hogan era, which, of course, so many people call it the golden era of wrestling. Basically, that, you know, that early mid-80s to the early 90s, WWF, that's where it was at. That's where the good times, if you will.
Absolutely, yeah.
Brad, thank you so much. But got to remind everybody else, the six pack on the open road in search of WrestleMania. Get the book. Get it April 2nd. And if you're listening to it after that, obviously get it immediately. But Brad, thank you so much for all the time. Really appreciate it.
All right, John. Thanks for having me.
This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron. And also check out the website, TMPTEmpire.com. And buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies. Brother. Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.